St. Francis called Brother Leo and said, "Come, I want you to write down what perfect joy is." So Brother Leo got his pencil and his paper, and he came. And Francis said, "If a messenger from Paris comes and tells us that all the great scholars and all the learned teachers of the academy in Paris have joined the order, that is not perfect joy. And if all the prelates of the church and the bishops and archbishops and even the king of France and the king of England come and join the order, that is not perfect joy. And if the brothers go and preach to the infidels and they're all converted to the love of Christ, that is not perfect joy. And if God pours out his grace upon us and we are able to cure the sick and do all manners of miracles, that is not perfect joy." Finally, Brother Leo looks up and says, well, what is perfect joy? And Francis says, "On the darkest night, when it's cold and the snow has piled up, and we're out walking, and icicles are forming in the folds of our robe, and those icicles are beating against our legs, and they begin to bleed, and we're walking in the cold and in the dark and of the snow, and after a long journey, we come to the friary, and we knock on the door, and we wait, and we knock again, and after a long time, the brother porter comes, and we say, 'Please let us in, we're cold and hungry.' And he says, 'Move along. We have plenty like you already. We're full up. We don't need you.' And we knock again. And we pound on the door and say, 'Please just let us in. We're so cold. It's Brother Francis and Brother Leo. You know us.' And he comes back and he says, 'You are both stupid and idiots. Now move along and don't make me tell you again.' And they pound on the door and say, 'Please just let us in for the night.' And he says, 'Not even to talk.' And he grabs a stick and he comes outside and knocks them down and beats them with the stick in the snow and says to them, 'You two vagabonds, you go about stealing from the poor. Now go off to the leprosy where you belong.' And slams the door and goes in. This, says St. Francis, this, if we can bear this in calm and patience, that is perfect joy, true virtue, and the salvation of souls." When I read this as an undergraduate, my head caved in. I couldn't even get, like, how could this be perfect joy, right? I couldn't even get to the idea that somehow we could be in such a state of grace, such a state of trust. I mean, I was still trying to figure out, like, how is getting beaten joy? It's so different from the image of St. Francis that we have. Yet we have this story on great authority. This seems to come from his mouth, unlike so many of the stories that we love about St. Francis. No, this one looks real. This is a very different image of St. Francis than the one we're accustomed to. You know, St. Francis is one of the most beloved saints. Even outside the church, St. Francis is all over the place, right? You see him in gardens everywhere, holding the bird bath, you know? He's right there, and the birds are on him, and the animals come to him. He's like a Christian Dr. Doolittle, you know? He's there, the animals trust him and like him. And we love this image of St. Francis. I mean, this is a kind of at oneness with nature. This idea that we could be in such right relationships that some fundamental restoration of our belonging to all of nature, and that animals would trust us and that we'd be at home here. So very different from perfect joy. And though it's hard to understand perfect joy and that story, I think the writer of Job understands it. This morning we begin about 4 weeks with the book of Job. And we know we're in the Old Testament because God and Satan are his characters and they're talking with one another. And the whole story gets set up. We're getting a little piece here where God is kind of bragging about Job to Satan and saying, "Have you seen my servant Job? He's quite a guy." And what's not in our text this morning is Satan says back, "Well, of course he loves you. And of course he's faithful. You've given him everything." And God allows Satan to go and take his flocks of sheep and goats and cows and knock down his house and kill all his children. And even so, Job persists. And now we see Satan saying, "Skin for skin. Let me reach out and touch him, and he'll do anything to save his life." It's disturbing that God says, "Okay." He takes the bet. And Satan covers Job with sores from the soles of his feet to the top of his head. And it says he's sitting on an ash heap. He's got a broken piece of pottery that he's scratching himself with. He's a vision of misery. And his wife says to him, "Curse God and die." And he says, "Am I not to receive the good from God as well as the bad?" The book of Job is in a tradition in Scripture called the wisdom literature. And it's kind of a minority report. You know, it's in Job and the Psalms, the Song of Songs, Ecclesiastes. You know the one you've heard, there's a time for everything. This is the wisdom tradition. And in this tradition, we take the long view. You know, it's all about how things work out ultimately. And in this tradition, it's often about seeing all of it, the whole picture of creation, the good and the bad, as being held by God. It's that kind of idea that it all works out. But yet, we live finite lives. We live lives of a singular perspective. And from that perspective, we see things as not working out, as being very bad for us. And there's a lot of suffering that comes into life. And yet, even here in the wisdom tradition, the book of Job is kind of the crown jewel because the character Job is going to challenge this tradition. He's going to say, "No. I want to know why." And the bulk of the book is all of his friends coming to kind of comfort him and say, "It's probably your own damn fault." And they go on and on and on, and Job keeps saying, no, I'm a good guy. I did nothing wrong. And ultimately, the answer to Job's question is one of perspective. Because Job faces God face to face at the end of the book. And what God says to Job is, "Where were you when I created everything? When I laid down the oceans and filled up the skies with snow and made the monsters in the sea and so on and so forth?" In short, he says, "I'm God. You're not." That's a hard teaching. And yet, this is the very teaching that St. Francis so beautifully and heroically embodies, which is to say, from the beginning, Francis really sought to live the gospel and walk in the footsteps of Jesus. In fact, that was the primitive rule, the first rule of St. Francis's community. That was the extent of it. And for Francis, that meant living a life of radical poverty. Poverty we cannot imagine. I mean, when we think about poverty, we think about it sort of simplifying, paring down. He made no provision for himself or his community. He lived in rags. He didn't eat. He begged. It was radical for the time. And so much of the misery of his life was having this rejected. You know, first by his father, and then by the city, ultimately by the church. The church really had a hard time with Francis. And finally by the very friars who came to follow him. This is too hard. And over again, they asked him to rewrite the rule. And he gives them to follow the gospel and walk in the footsteps of Jesus. And all they can say is, but what do you mean? It was too hard. And so we must remember that St. Francis suffered. He suffered in body, in spirit, psychologically. He lived a very tough life. But he was willing to do it. And he did so gladly. In St. Francis's time, the gospel was resisted. It's resisted today. It was resisted when Jesus brought it. There's no change. But St. Francis lived it to the very end. He died when he was about 44 years old. When he died, 2 years previously, he had been given the stigmata, which is wounds on his hands and feet and side. Those wounds never healed, and they continued to ooze blood. He also was covered with sores on his legs moving up into his abdomen, probably from malnutrition. In addition, he had some kind of stomach problem, either an ulcer or stomach cancer. So at the end of his life, he was vomiting blood. He was almost blind. They describe him as skin pulled over bones. This is a gruesome picture. I mean, this is the picture of a kind of death that no one would want. But the great scandal of the death of St. Francis is that he died joyful. He died singing. St. Francis was singing in this condition, and it was such a scandal that the brother Elias, the general of the order, comes to him and says, Francis, the people revere you as a saint. And this joy with which, well, it's sort of unbecoming of a good death. And he just looks back and says, you know, I feel so close to God. All I can do is sing. The Transitus, the death of St. Francis, is celebrated on October 3rd in the evening by Franciscan communities. And Francis died a death not unlike Jesus. It's a story with many ritual acts. Francis is taken from the city down to the Portuncula, the chapel where it all began, where he got his first message. And as they carry him down, they set him down and he offers a blessing over the city. And for those of you who've been to Assisi, it is unbelievably beautiful. I mean, this is a kind of Tuscan paradise. It's actually Umbria, but anyway, it's beautiful. And Francis continues on to offer forgiveness to his brothers and to ask their forgiveness. He blesses bread and breaks it and distributes it. Francis was never ordained. This is kind of confusing in the moment. What's he doing? So much the imitation of Christ that people were still couldn't see it. Finally, he said he was stripped naked and he wanted to be placed onto the earth. He said, to be naked that I might wrestle with the naked God. Naked that I might wrestle with the naked God. Francis, like Jesus, died with prayer on his lips. Psalm 142, he was saying, I lift my voice to the Lord. I make my supplication to the Lord. He welcomed Sister Death in the Canticle of the Sun. He created another verse, and he's singing this song, and he's praising and singing psalms, and he died. It's such a different picture of St. Francis than the birdbath St. Francis. And I think it's not a spirituality that's in ascendance. This idea. I mean, we live in a time of prosperity gospel, right? You come to believe in Christianity and God will make you wealthy and healthy and beautiful. And that's not what St. Francis was about. St. Francis is not about the crowning of the self. It's about the giving over of the needs of the self. He called himself Brother Ass, the body, the needs of Brother Ass. It's a very different spirituality. And I think it's one that we need to remember because our lives will involve suffering, the good and the bad. They will come our way. And we need to understand this in a holistic, almost wisdom approach. But I think it's very important for us to apply this to ourselves most of all. Because this is kind of a two-edged theology. It can very much be to bless injustice or bless suffering in the world. And Francis was hard on himself, but generous with others. There's a story of him at the beginning, where one of the brothers who's so sick of fasting calls out and says, I'm dying here. And he gets up and feeds him grapes and he eats them with him and just says, I don't want you to eat alone. This isn't a failure. You know, he was very compassionate to others, strict with himself. So I would just ask that you all remember the complexity of St. Francis, that he's so much more than the birdbath St. Francis, and to remember perfect joy and what that really means, the kind of groundedness in God and the certainty of the love of God that leaves us capable of living through all the difficulties of life. And we have our own angels and demons to wrestle with, just as he did. At the end of his life, he turned to his brothers and he said, I have completed my task. May Christ teach you to complete yours.